Hello and welcome to the Well Women Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Laura Pfeiffer. Today's episode, I'm talking all about endometriosis, everything you need to know about the topic. So this includes what it actually is, who's at risk, how you can get a proper diagnosis, and the things you can actually start doing today and implement in your life to help relieve your endometriosis symptoms. So I hope you guys enjoy. Thanks. For anyone who doesn't know me, my name is Dr. Laura Pfeiffer. I am a naturopathic doctor. Today, I wanted to talk about a topic that was heavily requested to hear about. So this is going to be available as a video, and that is in my Well Women Tribe Facebook group. And I'm also going to make this available as an audio podcast. For those of you who prefer to listen to audio only, then you can grab it on my Well Women podcast, and that's available anywhere you listen to podcasts. So let's just dive right into the topic. We are talking about understanding endometriosis. So if you know someone who has endometriosis, if you have been diagnosed yourself, or if you still don't have a diagnosis and you think that this is maybe what you have, then this is worthwhile watching to being able to understand not only endometriosis as a whole, but how I look at it from a naturopathic perspective and how it differs and can be in conjunction with a conventional perspective. So first of all, for those of you who don't know what endometriosis even is, endometriosis is defined as the presence of functioning endometrial tissue in sites outside the endometrial lining of the uterus. So what does that mean? That means that basically you have tissue in your uterus, and in endometriosis, it is outside of your uterus. So that really varies per person, and that's going to depend on how advanced it is, how severe it is, and that's really going to be what dictates the symptoms that you experience in your version of endometriosis. So, for example, if your sites are on top of the bowels or on top of the bladder, you might actually have more that are on top of the bowels and you have more painful bowel movements. Or if you only have them on the bladder, then you're going to have really painful urination. And a lot of people who have very severe endometriosis will end up having presence of endometrial tissue pretty much everywhere outside of their cavity, which causes a lot of pain, a lot of discomfort, and we'll kind of get into that. So who is impacted? Endometriosis occurs in females of reproductive age. Most common age at diagnosis is 25 to 29 years, and the risk is highest between women 40 and 44 years of age. And now that's kind of a skewed stat, and the reason why I'll say that is because a lot of times endometriosis is not identified, or it takes a long time to identify, and I'll talk about that when we get into diagnostics and kind of what that looks like, but it can take years to actually get a firm diagnosis. So it's most common of age of diagnosis is 25 to 29, but you could be suffering since the age of 14 or 15 or even 13 when you actually just get your period. Looking at genetics, family history for the disease is common. So if your mother had endometriosis, it is likely that you could also have that if you're exhibiting the same symptoms. So looking at those first degree relatives, there's a sevenfold increase in risk of endometriosis in first degree relatives. So that is your mother. If your mother had endometriosis, has been diagnosed formally or not, then that can actually increase your risk of having it as well. And so then we wonder, okay, if family history is big in your risk of having endometriosis, then what actually causes it? And that's really the question that we're still wondering. There are no definitive theories of what actually causes endometriosis. There are a bunch of different theories of what we think happens, but there's really no definitive answer with what causes endometriosis. And that's why, in my opinion, it is a lot, it has a lot of characteristics as an autoimmune concern or an autoimmune condition. Because of this reason, we don't really know the specific cause of it. And because of that, we look at a lot of immune system activation that isn't supposed to happen. So I'll give you a couple of the theories so you can kind of understand a background. But the first one is called retrograde menstrual flow. What that means is your menstrual blood actually backflows out of the fallopian tubes and goes into the fallopian tubes, ovaries, and other areas in the pelvis. So that's your, instead of coming out, obviously your menstrual flow is supposed to go from your uterus down through your vaginal canal and out. And so what this theory is saying is that the menstrual flow actually goes backwards up the fallopian tubes as opposed to towards the vaginal canal. And now this theory is actually interesting because it has been noted that retrograde menstrual flow does happen in a large number of women. However, not all of these women have endometriosis. So then again, that goes to show that there is some that can be left up to interpretation with respect to whether or not that is the true cause or whether it just is a factor to its existence. The second cause is called immune system surveillance. And so what this means is our immune system is working overtime all the time in order to look for things that are working and things that are not working and to be able to correct for those things that aren't working. And so what happens is when the immune system is functioning optimally, it takes care of this retrograde menstrual flow. And so, like I said, this happens in a lot of people where it will go backwards, it will have this retrograde flow. But because our immune system is functioning and working, it'll kind of take care of this debris. Our immune system kind of gets rid of it. When we have a disruption of our immune system, this allows this retrograde flow to wreak havoc. And so this is the reason why I don't think it's one of these factors or one of these causes, but I think it is multiple factors that are contributing to really the presentation of endometriosis. And so disruption in this immune surveillance can happen from a variety of things. Likely, it's going to be some or all of these factors, but we look at diet, stress, estrogen dominance, and autoimmunity. So I mentioned that I look at endometriosis as a little bit of an autoimmune condition, and you can understand why, because we have this immune surveillance that isn't working for some reason or another. And just like any other autoimmune concern, this is going to be triggered by things like diet, things like stress, things like environmental factors. Basically, with autoimmunity, you have a genetic predisposition to something, and then you have a trigger. So whether that trigger is a stressful event, whether it's a viral illness or something else, you have a trigger that sparks the cascade of the poor immune responses. And so again, we have this autoimmunity, and what ends up happening is the immune cells cause destruction to your body's own tissue. In this case, we have high levels of autoantibodies against the ovarian and endometrial cells. Another cause is endocrine, which is also hormone. So endocrine or hormone disruption. So we have estrogen disrupting chemicals that are linked to increased endometriosis rates. So that's looking at things like BPAs, plastics, chemicals, foundations that have phthalates in them, and all those endocrine disrupting chemicals that we have in our everyday lives that we might not even realize that we are exposing ourselves to. Things like plastic, when we're storing our food in plastics, even if we don't heat it, that's a huge, huge endocrine disruptor. So looking at our external environment as a trigger is really important as well. And then we have hormonal stimulation and an altered hormone response in our body as a result. So these estrogens stimulate endometrial tissue growth, which makes a lot of sense if we're looking at the menstrual cycle. I always explain it in two parts. The first part is estrogen. Estrogen is building the lining. It is making that lining thick and rich. It's the proliferative phase. And then we have the second half of the cycle, which is progesterone. That is our progest hormone, which is maintaining the lining. And so we need to have a balance of these two. But when we have external factors that are endocrine disrupting, we're going to have an imbalance in these two, and that can cause that estrogen stimulation. And then genetics, like I said, family history increases the risk. So signs and symptoms, and these are the things that you're looking out for so that you know that you need to ask your doctor if you are getting the testing or you need testing or if we should even have endometriosis as a differential diagnosis when you are looking at your concerns. We have things like painful periods, heavy periods, painful urination, bowel movements, or both. Like I said, it depends where the implants are. infertility or problems getting pregnant, chronic lower back pain and abdominal pain, pelvic pain, constipation, and usually this worsens over a lifetime. But the interesting thing is you can also have no symptoms. So if you are dealing with strictly infertility and we're really ruling out every other cause of infertility, it's worthwhile to look into things like endometriosis, or looking at uterine hyperplasia. So looking at that lining in your uterus being too thick. I thought this would be interesting to add in a little fun fact. So did you know that women with endometriosis have twice the rate of infertility than the general population? They have increased miscarriages and they have an increased risk of ectopic pregnancies. So endometriosis increases the risk of ectopic pregnancies. And so a diagnosis is difficult. The reason why is because something called a laparoscopy is the gold standard. This is a surgical procedure. So this is invasive, expensive, and not often done in order to confirm a diagnosis unless somebody is suffering really badly. And I'll go into that a little bit. But again, we're looking at the classic triad of symptoms, and that is dysmenorrhea, which is painful periods, painful sex, and infertility. The ultrasound can give us some information, but again, none of these symptoms, the ultrasound, are not diagnostic. So if you think you have endometriosis and you have these symptoms and you've had an ultrasound, this can give us more information, but technically this is not diagnostic of endometriosis. So first, before we actually diagnose endometriosis, we really need to rule out other things. So like I said, a laparoscopy is invasive and it is the gold standard. It's expensive, but we're not just going to go right in there and do a laparoscopy when we need to rule out other things first. So a few things that need to be ruled out before we're ruling in endometriosis is IBD, or inflammatory bowel disease, IBS, or irritable bowel syndrome, because we do have that bowel picture when it comes to endometriosis. You can actually have blood in your stool, you can have painful bowel movements, you can have constipation. So we really need to look at the digestive picture first. Primary dysmenorrhea, this is basically painful periods without a physical cause. So if we have a physical cause, that's something like fibroids or endometriosis. If we have painful periods without a physical cause, that can be things like lack of blood flow, nutrient deficiencies, that sort of thing. We need to rule out ovarian cysts. So there's a lot of other things we need to go through before we're actually deciding, okay, it's time to rule in or test for endometriosis. And now, how is it conventionally treated? So when we're looking at endometriosis from a conventional standpoint, so you've gone, your doctor says, you know what, you have endometriosis, now let's treat it. First line is things like NSAID. So we're looking at Advil, the birth control pill, which if you've listened to any of my other podcasts, I have a podcast all about birth control. So if you're wondering on more about that, head to that episode. Exercise has actually been shown to reduce the pain, but it is kind of like a vicious cycle, because if you're in pain, you don't want to exercise, and then you're in more pain, and then you still don't want to exercise, and it kind of keeps going on in a vicious cycle. Relaxation techniques, believe it or not, are part of conventional therapy because they are shown to work. And then we have things like surgical techniques and other medications. And now, surgical techniques, this is going to be a laparoscopy or any other open procedure. This requires excision and ablation. So they basically go in and they burn the extra tissue. So we do laser or cautery of all of the extra endometrial implants. So like I said, the tissue is outside of the uterus. It's going to be on the bowels, on the bladder, anywhere else. And so what they do is they actually go in and they burn that off. And so surgical excision of endometriosis has been shown to result in improved pain relief and improved quality of life after 6 months compared to a laparoscopy alone. So laparoscopy versus laparoscopy plus surgical excision of the endometriosis. The most comprehensive treatment is a total hysterectomy and a dissection of the implants. So you have to think, this is a huge, huge decision you're making if you are getting a total hysterectomy, which is basically removing your uterus. So you are no longer able to have kids. So depending where you're at in life, where you're at with your hormones, if they want to remove your ovaries or not, that can be an extremely huge decision that if you haven't had children yet, probably isn't an option on the table. And depending how old you are, if you are in your late 40s, then maybe hysterectomy doesn't sound like such a bad idea. But if you're in your 20s, it really is a life-altering event to your hormones really, really early on and can be pretty bad. And so, is it successful? If we do this surgery, is it successful? So the success rate is about 45 to 85%, which is a huge range. I mean, if you're at that 85%, and I'm not talking with the hysterectomy, I'm talking with the ablations, the ones that are not obviously taking out your uterus, the success rate is 45 to 85%. So if you are on that lower end, that sucks. If you're on that higher end, if you're 85%, you're in that 85% that has that success, then that's amazing. But that range is huge. So you're really doing a pretty invasive procedure for something that might not even give you relief. And on top of that, the rate of recurrence is about 20 to 60% after 5 years. So if you had the ablation and then you had a 50% chance of everything coming back after 5 years, then that's not really a great thing. You don't want to keep having to do this every 5 years. And there's complications in 1 to 6% of the cases. So after the laparoscopy, unless pregnancy is desired, usually this is followed by hormonal contraceptives and ovarian suppression. And so again, that's giving you more hormones. Some people don't do well with birth control or oral contraceptives. And I know a lot of those patients that do not do well with those type of treatments. Laparoscopy, though, on a positive note, has shown to yield a 65% pregnancy rate after 2 years in patients with endometriosis-associated infertility. So on the flip side, doing a laparoscopy has resulted in pregnancy rates. And 65% is a really good chance in somebody who's had re a really hard time conceiving. So when you're looking at the conventional treatments, you really, really need to weigh your options. And no, you might be thinking, okay, I have endometriosis. I think I'm going to do a laparoscopy. And really, a laparoscopy is only considered when someone has severe pain over several months, pain requiring systemic therapy. So if you have to be on like NSAIDs, which is Advil, or something stronger every single day, there's a lot of side effects that can come with that. And one of those is GI bleeding. So if that's the weighed option, then you might actually end up getting a laparoscopy because of the risk of being on NSAIDs for that long. If you have pain that's resulting in days off from work or school, pain requiring admission to the hospital, if your medication's ineffective, if you want to get pregnant, because I mentioned there's a high success rate for pregnancy in people who have otherwise shown infertility. And the other thing is at the patient's request. And I think that just depends on what doctor you happen upon. Second line treatments, we're looking at things like hormonal IUD, we're looking at Depo-Provera, we're looking at oral progestins, and the satisfaction rate with this is 80 to 90%. But I do want to urge you to go check out my birth control episode on my podcast because I do talk about the side effects of Depo-Provera, and one of those side effects is actually reduced bone density. And so, depending on what age you're at, I mean, I don't think any woman should have a reduced bone density. However, if you are an older woman, the risk of fracture is higher. If you are a younger woman, then you are actually meeting your peak bone mass. And you really have to weigh the pros and cons of whether or not it's worth it to increase your fracture risk for that type of treatment. Other things, we have things, medications called GnRH analogs. These have been shown to decrease pain up to 90%. And these you can stay on for a maximum of 6 months. But if it's effective, you can consider it being a long-term treatment. And then there's another medication that can improve symptoms 80 to 90%. This is called Danazol. Again, maximum 6 months because there is long-term side effects, androgenic side effects. And so what that means is that's going to be like male pattern side effects. So increased facial hair and things like that. So again, a lot of these options don't really sound great. A lot of them are not long-term and a lot of them do not fix the, well, none of them actually fix the problem. So, like I said, most patients have a recurrence after medical treatment, and surgery comes with risk and complications. And then, if you have a recurrence after you have surgery, then that's really tough. So why would you see a naturopathic doctor? Well, like I said, medications are not sustainable long term. There's high recurrence rates. A lot of people are looking for symptom relief. A lot of people are looking to get pregnant. And it's really important just to understand all of your options. A lot of people suffering from endometriosis just see this diagnosis and they feel like there's nothing that they can do about it and there's nothing that will change anything, and that really surgery is their best bet or medication is their best bet, and they might end up feeling worse being on these sort of treatments. So here's some lifestyle modifications that I wanted to start with. Things you can start doing today. Number one is to exercise. Exercise has actually been shown to decrease estrogen, decrease inflammatory mediators, reduces estrogen production and increases its excretion. So really getting everything moving, getting those waste products out, getting that excess estrogen. Because like I mentioned, estrogen is what's going to build that lining. If we have too much, we're going to build too thick of a lining, and that can actually, the excess estrogen can actually lead to those implants elsewhere that we don't want. Number two is to stop smoking. There has been shown a correlation in the research to smoking and an increase in symptoms. Number three is weight loss, and that's if indicated. If you are somebody who is of average weight or normal weight, weight loss probably won't help, and it actually might hurt in a variety of other ways impacting your hormones. So your weight does have to be at a healthy level, but if you do have an increased BMI or your body mass index, or you are overweight, weight loss would be indicated here. And then avoiding exogenous estrogen. So like I was saying before, looking at those exogenous estrogens, so things like BPA and BPA-free plastic, so plastic in general, makeup products, lotions, shampoos. You would be so shocked to read the ingredients on a lot of the things you put on your body that are disrupting your hormones. So just make sure you read your labels. You're looking for phthalates, you're looking for parabens. When in doubt, a really, really good resource is the Environmental Working Group. Those who follow me or know me or are patients of mine know that I recommend the Environmental Working Group all the time. Go there, look at, you can type in a product and it'll come up. It'll tell you the ingredients that they flag and it'll go through why. So you don't have to be a chemist or a scientist to know kind of what you're looking for when you're looking for these ingredients. But make sure, if it says BPA-free, I still would not use it. When you are drinking your beverages, drink it out of stainless steel or glass. That's it. Don't go with anything plastic. Now, the second thing to do is to look at your gut. Moving your bowels every single day is so important. And this is where you might actually need a little bit more assistance. You might need to work with someone, work with your naturopathic doctor, or anyone else who's helping you in that department. Healthy detoxification pathways will help to regulate your hormones. So we need to make sure things are moving. When we're talking about moving your bowels, it's not about taking a laxative. I want you to look for your food sensitivities, heal your gut, and manage your stress. Those are the three pillars of looking at your gut. And this isn't about gut health, so I won't really go into detail, but with food sensitivities, the gold standard is the elimination diet. I myself have never done it and will never do it because it is a very strenuous, intense, strict diet that cannot be broken, and it takes quite a long time. So a lot of my patients don't end up doing it. I do have a few that will do it, have done it, and I am 100% equipped to guide them through that, but it is a process. So I'm very honest with my patients when I'm talking about the elimination diet and how strenuous it actually is. The other option to look at food sensitivities is what I call the quick and dirty option. That is getting your food sensitivity test done. That is a blood test. It tells you what you are sensitive to, and that can easily be interpreted and read and used. And that can actually help with the bowel piece, but it can also help with anything else. Migraines, a lot of time, joint pain, inflammation, headaches. Sorry, I already said migraines. But it's really great to take a look at your food sensitivities if you're suffering from constipation, if you are not having a bowel movement every single day, feeling complete, not having any bloating, no abdominal pain, all of those sorts of things. Take a look at that. And if you're having belching or you have heartburn, something is up with your gut, and that is going to impact your hormones. So It may be that your endometriosis needs to be tackled at your gut first. It may be that you and your naturopathic doctor take 6 months focusing on your gut before they even move to anything hormonal. And that would actually make a lot of sense. So when it comes to naturopathic medicine, it is really, really important to work with somebody who knows what to do first, because anyone can look online and Google natural treatments for endometriosis, but that's really not the way to fix anything. It's really about looking at you as a person and saying, okay, where are all the holes? Where do we need to fill the gaps? And where do we start? Because that's the biggest thing, is knowing where to start, where to go next, and what to start with. Because there is so many things online. And like I said, you can Google how to treat endometriosis naturally, and you're going to get a ton of information. But how do you know which one to start with? You can probably Google endometriosis and you can find curcumin. And there's lots of great research on how curcumin is an anti-inflammatory, and it's amazing and it reduces pain. But should you start there? Should you take curcumin? And at what dose and what brand? And is it going to fix the root cause? So I would beg you to take a look at that and ask yourself those questions before going forward with that. But I would say looking at your gut is a critical, critical, critical point. I wanted to make a note about something called beta-glucuronidase. This is an enzyme and it's produced by bacteria in the gut. It basically uncouples the bond between estrogen and glucuronic acid, so estrogen re-enters your circulation. And so I'll explain that a little bit better. What happens is when you're getting rid of estrogen, your hormones are processed two ways: through your bowels, through your liver. And so this is why I urge you to look at your gut, because your gut is part of that estrogen detoxification process. So it's going to go through your bowels and through your liver. And what happens when it goes through these processes is it gets broken down, and then it gets coupled up with other enzymes, and then it gets shipped out of your body. And so this enzyme called beta-glucuronidase actually uncouples that bond, allowing estrogen to be free again and being able to recirculate in your body. The problem with that, in normal amounts, your beta-glucuronidase is there to help protect. So it's there to make sure your estrogen stays balanced. A lot of mechanisms in our body are looking at creating balance. So we're bringing our estrogen back in, we are recycling it, we're bringing it back around so that we're able to use it again in an effective manner. But what happens is if we have too much beta-glucuronidase, we're going to uncouple too much estrogen, and we're going to have too much estrogen recycling and use that again. Our body sees that hormone come back through and it goes, oh, this looks like it would be helpful, and it uses it again. And this can be to our detriment. So this is also a note in looking at your gut as well. Balancing the bacteria, good and bad, is really important. And that's going to be in all of those ways, like I mentioned, looking at diet, looking at stress, etc. Looking at diet specifically when it comes to endometriosis, things to avoid. So, in the research, things that have been shown to cause problems, wreak havoc in endometriosis, things like refined carbohydrates, alcohol, so limiting or avoiding alcohol altogether, meat, especially red meat, saturated fat, again, a lot of saturated fat from those meat. From those meats, I wouldn't say we're avoiding things like coconut oil, because I haven't seen the research to suggest that it worsens endometriosis, but definitely meat, vegetable oils, so all those inflammatory oils like canola oil. Again, looking at those food sensitivities, because anything you are sensitive to is going to cause inflammation. So it can be fine in someone else, but in you, it wreaks havoc. A couple notes I wanted to make is on coffee. A lot of people were. Or a lot of things you see may say, avoid coffee on endometriosis, in endometriosis. I'm personally a coffee lover, and coffee does have a lot of antioxidants. It's got a lot of great research to back it up as well. So I actually looked at some research, and a meta-analysis provided no evidence for an association between coffee or caffeine consumption and the risk of endometriosis. And it's shown that it doesn't carry a health risk with respect to endometriosis. So my note on coffee would be that I would say one coffee a day and watch what you put in it. If your coffee is loaded with cream and sugar, it's not good for any condition. If your coffee is black, then it's wonderful. If your coffee is a bit of almond milk, it is fine. So just keep an eye on that. If you're drinking five coffees a day, then I want to talk about your adrenal health. But with respect to endometriosis as a concern, I don't think coffee specifically is going to be the problem. So that might be good news for some of you. Going gluten-free is interesting, because the research has been shown a connection between endometriosis and celiac disease. So people who had celiac disease were likely to have endometriosis, and this is where I'll kind of loop back to autoimmune disease being the root cause for endometriosis, because people who have one autoimmune disease are likely to have another autoimmune disease, which is really interesting to note. But a 2012 study showed at 1 year follow-up, 75% of the patients reported a statistically significant change in their painful symptoms. 25% of patients reported no improvement of symptoms, but no patients reported worsening of pain. So this was a year of going gluten-free. 75% of patients reported a change in their symptoms. So it could be worth trying, and it's really worth making sure that if you're going gluten-free, you actually understand what that means, understand what that entails, and really get that guidance, because a lot of people, and I'll see a lot of patients who will tell me they went gluten-free for 2 weeks and didn't notice anything. I will say, number one, 2 weeks isn't long enough, and number two, were you actually gluten-free to the T? There's a lot of places gluten hides that people are really unaware of. So if I have a patient and I think that it is clinically relevant for them to go gluten-free, I will go through all of the resources with them to show them exactly how to go gluten-free, what that means, and how they're supposed to go about it. Foods to include. I thought this was going to be a really interesting discussion, because foods to include for endometriosis. So lots of anti-inflammatory stuff. Cruciferous vegetables, broccoli, cauliflower, Brussels sprouts. These are all in the cruciferous veg family, cabbage, and they basically help get rid of estrogen. So I was mentioning the bowels and the liver. These help with that liver portion of getting rid of those excess estrogens. Flaxseed is another amazing one. I tell people, for a lot of hormonal concerns, 2 tablespoons of flaxseed a day in your smoothie. Or if you want to just be hardcore, you can chug it back in some water, but really up to you. The interesting, controversial one, I will say, is soy, because soy is a phytoestrogen, and I know what you're going to say is soy has been shown to be a phytoestrogen. So a lot of people think phytoestrogen equals estrogen, so I need to stay away from soy. So I wanted to clear up the soy problem. And the thing with soy is it is just that, is a phytoestrogen. What that means is it's a plant-based substance that mimics an estrogen. And so earlier on, I was talking about exogenous estrogens, things like BPA, things like phthalates, chemicals that we see in our environment that act like estrogens, and they disrupt our chemicals or our hormones. So I want you to picture a receptor. And so you have a receptor that is open to receiving two estrogens, let's say. So we have the estrogen we made by our body, and we have one open receptor that's just kind of sitting there. What's going to happen is if we have something like BPA or parabens or phthalates, the chemical exposures in our products, we get that chemical and it will bind to our estrogen receptor. And what it'll do is it will actually bind tighter than our own estrogen, and therefore it will have harder, more intense effects than our own estrogen. Now, let's take that same receptor. Let's say that there's two spots. One is our own estrogen, the other's open. Now we have something like soy or flaxseed, things that act like phytoestrogens. What they actually do is they come in and they bind that empty space, that receptor, with a less potent effect. So now what we're doing is we have our own estrogen at one spot. Now we have our phytoestrogen at the other spot. And now we expose ourselves to BPA or parabens or phthalates. And now there's no spot for them to bind. And where the soy or the phytoestrogen is bound, it's not having a detrimental effect. In fact, it's not even having as strong of an effect as our own hormone. So when we are having these phytoestrogens, they are actually having a protective effect against these more harmful estrogens that can actually do a lot of harm to us. And so that's the benefit when we're looking at phytoestrogens. They help to balance our own estrogens. What I will say about soy is it needs to be organic and not genetically modified. Those are the two criteria. Otherwise, soy is actually pretty great. The other thing that's interesting is a vegetarian diet has been shown to be really beneficial in endometriosis. I mentioned avoiding meat, avoiding saturated fats, because more red meat has been shown to increase negative symptoms in endometriosis. And so there was a study looking at 504 women. And they compared, so 504 women with endometriosis compared to 504 women without endometriosis. They found that there was a 40% decreased risk in women who ate high amounts of green vegetables and fresh fruit. And there was an 80% increased risk of endometriosis in women who ate high amounts of beef, ham, and other red meats. So again, worth considering going on a vegetarian diet or more of a heavily plant-based diet. Again, getting guidance on that is key. Whether you're seeing your naturopathic doctor or your nutritionist, you don't have to do it alone. A note on vitamin D I found really interesting. I will preface this with, you need to test your vitamin D before treating. It is a fat-soluble vitamin, so that means that whatever you take, it's storing. You will not pee it out. Your body does not get rid of the excess. So I find a few scenarios happen. People have low vitamin D levels and they don't know how to dose. And so they're either overdosing, underdosing, or not doing anything at all. And all of those scenarios are not good, because not doing anything, keeping things stable, is really a waste of money if you're low and you're keeping it at that level. Overdosing can really, really be dangerous because it throws off a lot of your other nutrients, but also, it's bad for your bone health. And I mean, you can actually overdose on vitamin D, so be concerned about that. And I mean, underdosing, again, it's not really doing anything. It's money down the drain. You also need to make sure you're getting the right supplement. So there's a lot of things that go into vitamin D, but vitamin D has been shown to reduce inflammation, regulate cell growth, improve endometriosis-related symptoms, and increase healthy cholesterol levels, which are associated with a reduction in symptoms of endometriosis. So when we increase our healthy cholesterol, we're shown to reduce symptoms of endometriosis. I'm not going to tell you about herbs to include, because there are a ton, and I think that whether or not I would use them in specific conditions or specific patients really, really, really depends on the patient, what we're doing first, what our combination is, what our allergies are, what our other conditions are. Usually we are not dealing with endometriosis in isolation. So taking all of those factors into consideration, I would decide. But there's a couple herbs that I would tell you to strictly avoid, because I know there's a lot of people who are trying to self-treat. They're trying to use Dr. Google. So I'm going to forewarn you about these specific herbs. Trifolium pratense and Humulus lupulus. These two herbs exhibit a stronger activity in the body than an endogenous estrogen. So these may be contraindicated. So like I was telling you before, they help with estrogen, but they might be too strong for endometriosis. Two other herbs, Camelarium luteum and Dioscorea villosa. These two herbs can, again, promote estrogenic symptoms. And this is what somebody with endometriosis is already experiencing. So not that these herbs are going to do that in everyone, but if you are somebody who has endometriosis, I certainly would not be giving you these two. Acupuncture is another thing I wanted to introduce with respect to endometriosis. The current literature suggests that acupuncture reduces pain and serum CA125 levels, and that is basically a marker that can be used to follow endometriosis. And so it's been shown to reduce that in people with endometriosis, relieve pain, and it can also regulate your menstrual cycle. If you have heavy periods, acupuncture can help to reduce that heaviness as well. So getting some pain relief and that sort of thing. It's nice if you're already taking a bunch of supplements to be able to do something different, to be able to do something to add on. So acupuncture is a good addition additional treatment to whatever your treatment plan looks like. I like doing acupuncture once a week, usually for 4 to 6 weeks. We reevaluate in 4 weeks, especially when we're doing anything related to the menstrual cycle. We need to wait till another cycle comes to kind of see what happens. So I usually like to try to do 5 weeks and then maybe tack on another week if we feel like we want one more and then kind of go from there. Castor oil packs is something else that I really, really love. It's been shown to reduce lesions. It treats inflammation. It's also super easy to do and relaxing. If you haven't done a castor oil pack before, I suggest you do it. The only time I would say not to is if you are pregnant or if you are on your period. It is contraindicated in those scenarios, but basically you are not drinking castor oil. Do not drink castor oil. You are basically taking castor oil and rubbing it on your stomach. I had a teacher that once told me boobs to pubes, so you can just get the visual there. You're basically rubbing it on your entire abdomen, in a circular motion. You can even get someone else to do it. It can be a nice relaxing massage, and you're basically doing that. And you're going to take that, or you're going to put on an old t-shirt and call it a day. You can go to bed like that, and it'll usually absorb. It will stain, though, so make sure it's an old crappy shirt. Your other option is to rub it on, massage it on, and then add an old towel and some heat. Ideally, if you are going to add some heat, make sure you are using organic cotton because you are basically leaching from that material. And then you can kind of just chill out for half an hour, watch your favorite show, read a book, whatever you like to do, and then let it absorb. But you can do that every night if you like as your self-care. You can do that every other night. You can do that a couple days a week, whatever kind of works best for you. But it's a good addition to any kind of self-care plan. I just wanted to make another note on herbs or supplements. There are lots. Like I said, you need to get an individualized approach based on your goals and your priorities, your allergies, your tolerance, your pre-existing conditions, your overarching treatment plan. You need to make sure that you're treating the whole picture, and it's your picture. It's not just endometriosis as a picture versus going to a health food store and asking to treat one symptom. So if you go in, they might give you things like curcumin, they might give you ginger, they might give you I don't know, dim. They might give you a cruciferous vegetable supplement. They might give you really anything else. Magnesium. There's so many things that there is some research on. There's other things that there aren't. But we really need to make sure that, like I said, number one, we're getting the whole picture. We're looking at an entire intake. We're seeing, okay, what is your presentation like? What are the overarching goals? What are your goals? And where do I think we need to start? Is stress a big picture? Are we not sleeping? Where else can inflammation be found? Where is this autoimmunity happening? Is there celiac disease? Is there a thyroid component? What else is going on? Is the main goal fertility? Are we trying to get pregnant? Then that's going to look very, very different than somebody whose main goal is to reduce pain. What is your level of pain? That's going to determine the type of treatment plan we go over. So your naturopathic doctor might want to start with something else before starting X supplement. So yes, curcumin sounds great, and I keep mentioning it as an example because you're going to find a lot of information on Google about curcumin and endometriosis because it is lovely. But do you need it? Maybe, maybe not. We might actually not use it because it doesn't actually make sense in your case. Curcumin is a great thing to add to your diet if you want to do that. It can be a little bit less potent, but it definitely isn't going to be a cure-all or fix-all because it is a whole system approach. So take-home points of this endometriosis talk is that endometriosis is a whole body condition. Your diet and lifestyle will need to be addressed. You need to determine where your main goals are and work from there. So between you and your practitioner, you need to make sure that you understand what the main goals are. Herbs and supplements can be helpful, but they must be tailored to your situation. So again, just because it's natural does not make it safe. You need to make sure you're getting the right appropriate quality supplement, the right therapeutic dose, and you're taking the right things in combination. And that's really, really the key. And then again, don't forget to address stress, the gut, your external environment, your sleep, all of the other things that have a hand in perpetuating, worsening, and bettering this condition. And looking at stress, looking at anxiety, a lot of times I even end up referring out to the therapist because they need that mental health component looked at, because you can't discount the impact of your mental health on your physical conditions. So looking at this whole systems approach and making sure we develop the best treatment plan for you is really the most important. So that's pretty much it for this lecture. If you have any questions, you can always send an email to laura@laurapyfer.com. For those watching the video, you can comment below and I will answer any questions I can. If you are not already, follow me on Instagram at Dr. Laura ND. You can find me on Facebook, Dr. Laura Pyfer, Naturopathic Doctor. And if you are listening to this podcast and you want to get into the Well Women Tribe, head to Facebook, search the Well Women Tribe, or head to my Instagram and click the link in my bio. You will find it there. If you are looking to book an appointment, you can head to the link in my bio on Instagram, or you can head directly to laurapyfer.com and check it out there. Thanks for listening.